Welcome to Digitally Creative. I'm your host, Vincent Ferrari, and joining me this week is someone who I thought was a digital producer, but is actually just incredibly talented. I have someone I've been following a very, very long time on Instagram. He is Chris Temple from Hang It Up Art. What's going on, Chris? How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I was telling Chris beforehand, and I swear I've never been so shocked at something. And it's like, you're getting my genuine reaction to this when I tell you guys this. I was reading through Chris's profile because I always like to jump into someone's Instagram right before I have them on the show. And I jump in, I look through their stuff, just kind of refresh my memory a little bit because I don't like to do like formal prep. I like to just have a conversation with guests. And I've been following Chris long enough where it's like, oh, this is not going to be hard to do at all. And I get to his profile, and the second line of his profile says, hand cut with a jigsaw and spray painted by me. Guys, he does all the stuff he does with a jigsaw. You know the tool you all hate? That's what Chris does, and that's how he does it. Chris, that is absolutely mind-boggling, dude. Absolutely mind-boggling.
Well, thank you.
Why don't you, before we go too far into how incredibly cool the stuff you make is, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started with this, because you seem to have found a very good niche for yourself. And I love, one of the things I love about your Instagram account is when you do like a craft show or like some kind of show, and you have the wall of all the stuff that you've made, and there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of pieces, every one of them unique, not like 50 of the same one. So your niche is so specific. I'm kind of wondering how you got started, what your early education was like. Do you have any formal training? That kind of stuff. All the usual stuff that people, like a small bio of what you do.
I've always been artistic growing up, like in high school, did like drawing and painting and stuff like that. Not really so much in woodwork, but a few years ago, I just started like working with a jigsaw and doing stuff for my wife, you know, making just decorations around the house. Like she's into like farm decor kind of thing. So like I'll do a chicken silhouette or a cow silhouette out of like very rustic wood. Like I would get like old fence boards and then like whitewash them. And then some people would have me buy them and stuff, or buy them from me. But I'm not into that. That didn't really appeal to me. And when the pandemic hit, it shut down my wife and I's business. We own a wedding photography and photo booth rental company, and events just stopped. So yeah. I had nothing to do. I was bored. My son had just started getting to the age where he was getting into Star Wars, and I asked him, would you like me to make you something for your wall? And so I was like, okay, I'll make you a Millennium Falcon. And so, which is kind of hard for the first thing I've ever made. It turned out to be much harder. And I look back at it and I'm like, that was not very good. But
so I made into it.
I made it for him. And then I made him an AT-AT walker or an AT-AT walker, however people say it. I made that. And then I would say maybe 6 months later, he was like, I'm not really into Star Wars anymore. So I was like,
wow.
I was just like, okay, that's fine. Do you want to sell these? Like, see if we can sell them on Facebook Marketplace, and you can use the money for Christmas money, because it was right before Christmas. And he was like, sure. So sold them, and they sold pretty well. Granted, they were pretty cheap compared to what I make now. And then people just were like, can you make this? Can you make this? And so I started, sure, I can make that. And it kind of grew from there. And then as I got better and got more confident and things started to open up after the pandemic, I was like, hey, there's a Comic-Con coming up. I'll sign up. And then I look at the Comic-Con booth that I have, and it's like, you said you saw my booth before, and it's like full of stuff. Before, when I first started, it maybe had 10% or maybe 15% of what I have now. So it looks empty. So I did that. And it still did pretty well. Like if people were coming up and this is awesome, it looks so great. And it just kind of grew from there. And now I'm in a few different stores in my local area. I've do multiple cons a year, do a lot of custom orders. And I do this full time now. I didn't really go back to my photo booth rental company that kind of let it go. I mean, I still do it every once in a while, but this has kind of become my passion, and it's what I do full time now. It takes pretty much all my time. I have to like force myself to stop so that I could do other things.
That's that. You know, it's funny. I hear that a lot with people who are really just doing something they love doing, where it's they have that bit of trouble just kind of taking it down a notch. Like, okay, downtime now. It's okay to have downtime.
Exactly. Like before this almost forces me to stop and be patient, because like the primer has to dry, the paint has to dry. You can't rush. And then like the cutting takes a certain amount of time. You can't rush anything. But before this, sometimes I would be like, I just want to get it done. And that leads to rushing and then skipping steps or not doing as well as you could. And in the product not being as good as you can. So this is almost like helping me with that. Like, okay, it's going to take a certain amount of time. Give yourself time for that. Like, the primer has to dry for at least 24 hours. Some people, they do it a lot quicker, but I let it 24 hours. And then the paint has to dry a certain amount of time. The glue has, it's like, so you're
it forces you to just kind of take a step back, let the process happen. And, you know, the good thing is you're so busy and you're so prolific in what you're doing that, you know, if you really wanted to be Mr. Go, 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 you could actually just make another piece now while that one's drying. And I imagine, and I could be wrong, but I just imagine your work area is just like a whole bunch of pieces at various stages of being finished, because I can't imagine you working on one until it's done, then working on another till it's done.
No. it wouldn't be very efficient. So like what I like to do is I'll cut a bunch of pieces and then once they're all cut, then I'll sand them all and then I'll prime them all. And then once they're all primed, I like to take all the pieces and divide it up by color, and then I'll paint them. And then, because it makes it easier if a piece has four colors and another piece has five colors, but some of the colors match, I can paint them together, and it makes the painting process quicker. So that's what I like to do. And then once they're all painted, and then I glue them all together. But if I were to cut a piece, sand a piece, prime a piece, paint a piece, then cut another piece, prime another piece, it would just be not as efficient. It takes so much longer.
Plus you work, and one of the things I like about your work is there's dimensionality to it, because you don't just like cut one piece and paint it. You cut a piece and you work in layers, even on one piece. There's the All Might piece you just did is a good example of that. The Demon Slayer logo you did, like those are just some of the most recent ones, but there's dimensionality to it. So you're not just cutting out one shape and then painting it with outlines or whatever. You're cutting out the next layer and the next color and the next color and the next color, which I think that's something that's very unique to the way you're doing this. Because there's a lot of people making wall art and they're all very flat. You give it a lot of dimensionality just by layering the different colors onto different pieces and attaching them forward. It kind of looks really cool that way.
Thanks. Yeah, I like doing that way. It's not how I started. I did start out not really knowing what like my style was going to be, what my niche was going to be. And so I would hand paint, I would do like the main piece and then like hand paint the details and then I was like, oh, I don't really like doing that very much. So then I bought an airbrush and I try to airbrush the details, and it's just, and then sometimes at one point I try to do, pastel markers and pens. And I was like, well, what if I, one day it just kind of clicked. It was like, what if I like made another piece, piece and put it on top. And then it kind of went like, okay, now I'm doing two layers. And then it kind of grew from there. Like, well, then like now I have done pieces that have like nine layers, and like it gets really thick. And so sometimes when it gets to a piece that's like so many layers, I'll use like vinyl. I'll cut pieces of vinyl. Mm-hmm. If it's like a small detail, like a small piece or something like that, where it wouldn't really translate, like it might be too thick, something like that, then I'll use vinyl. But yeah, I really like doing the layers.
It also looks cleaner, because you're not going to have one color bleeding into another. They're just sitting on top of each other. So as long as you can glue straight, everything's going to look great.
Yeah, sometimes, it's like sometimes I'll use like a template, like I'll print a piece of paper out with the thing and use it as a template. And then sometimes I just eyeball it with the gluing.
Paper templates, there's a lot of woodworkers. There's a lot of woodworkers that don't use like any kind of anything except for paper. They don't have, some of them I know don't even have jigs. It's just like they just use paper templates, print them out as you need them, cut them, throw them away when you're done. It's, I'm always amazed by it. I mean, look, I'm a laser guy. I love lasers. I love CNCs. I love 3D prints. And that's one of the reasons that your work is even more impressive to me now. So you were doing wedding props and photo booth rentals and stuff. So I imagine your props were on a bigger scale and you're just using the same tools. You've just downsized the end product from what you were already doing, right?
I never made any of the props and stuff for the photo booths.
We would just
rent out photo booths for weddings.
And
we'd set up the photo booth and people would take photos and stuff like that. But I actually never made anything for the booth.
I gotcha.
So
what have you noticed as far as your process, goes? Have you noticed anything, or can you think of anything that's changed a lot where you did something a certain way at the beginning and now you already mentioned that you were doing stuff more flat and hand painting and stuff, but has anything in your process changed, or are you still kind of doing it mostly the same way you were doing it early on? Not necessarily at the very beginning, but have you kind of stayed in a groove for a while?
Yeah. So one thing that has cut down a lot of time is I'd make a template, like, so whatever I'm going to make, I would blow it up in Photoshop. Then I would crop it into printable size pieces, print it out, and then tape it together and then put it on the wood. I would just do one layer, cut the bottom layer, whatever I felt was going to be the bottom layer. And then take that template and move it to another piece of the board, cut the second layer, and do the same thing. But now I mostly do like stacked cutting, where what you do is you take the template, put it on the piece of paper, and then use contact paper in between, and you with spray adhesive, glue multiple layers together, and you cut it all at the same time. So if it's like a three-layer piece, I'll have three pieces of wood glued together, then cut it out, and then pry the bottom layer off. And then now I only have to cut off what is going to be the second layer off.
Wow.
And then so forth. It's kind of, it's a little bit difficult to explain, but it just makes it so that I don't have to do I only cut the border once. And then everything else that I'm progressively cutting is just the pieces that are being removed from progressively higher layers.
And you're getting progressively smaller as you get closer to the top. So you're not cutting away the whole sheet every single time you do the stuff.
And then it makes it so that everything lines up better too, because I've cut it all at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're not, that's the one thing I always have, like, even with digital stuff, I always have a problem if I'm trying to do something that needs to fit into something else and you get that one wonky angle or one wonky nick of a blade and all of a sudden nothing fits together anymore. That does kind of solve it. Man, you've sounds like you thought of everything. I mean,
yeah. And like with cutting with a jigsaw, like, it takes just over the past 3 years, just different techniques of how to cut out small little pieces without them flying off or without nicking my fingers, things like that, you know?
Because you do work with very thin materials. I mean, you're not working with like half inch plywood. You're working with like basically quarter inch and eighth inch stuff.
Yeah, it's called, what I typically use is, the store is 5.2 millimeter, which is just a little bit thinner than a quarter of an inch. But I like using that. It allows me to do multiple layers without it being like inches thick.
and weighing a ton.
Yeah, exactly. I could do like three or four layers on a piece and it's still under an inch.
One of the things, people that know me know this about me, but one of the things that I like to see myself as is like a geeky pop culture enthusiast.
Yeah.
And a lot of your work, like every time you make something, I feel like I get like every reference, and it's kind of fun. Like, it's just, even when you show like the big wall of your work, it's like, I know what that is. Your interests seem to line up very closely with mine. I always dig that. What kind of pop culture are you into, or are you just making stuff that you kind of get inspired and make it? Because one of the things you made is something I've been dying to make, on a much smaller scale. You made Tanjiro's Hanafuda earrings from Demon Slayer. And you made a big one, and I was like, I never thought to make a big one. That's actually a really good idea. I should do that, because I took it into Photoshop, took a screen grab, took it into Photoshop, distorted it enough so it looked good, and then I worked on it in Illustrator for what felt like an eternity to try to get something that I could work with. But I saw that you made it, and I'm like, oh my God, our interests are very much aligned. It's funny, because I'm saying this as I'm looking at the screen here, and there's the Demon Slayer logo right in front of me, and I can see other Demon Slayer stuff, but your interests seem to be very much along the lines of pop culture geekery, and I kind of like that. So what kind of stuff do you do?
I've always been into that kind of stuff, and anime and movies and comic books, but my interest and my time is limited. So there's a lot of times where I'm making pieces that I have no idea what it is. You know, it's like, 'cause I've over the past 3 years and doing multiple cons and supplying multiple stores with products. I can't know everything. So it's like,
sure.
People will say like, oh, you should make this piece. And I just, by hearing people talking and they're saying different animes popular, I do Google searches and ask my followers what I should make and based on that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I enjoy making pieces that I like and that I think would be cool. And I mean, honestly, when someone asks me to do a piece that I have no idea, I'm obviously not going to be as passionate about it. I mean, I still enjoy it and I think it's cool, but it's just, it's hard to like get as passionate about something that I don't know anything about, but it does happen. And because I only know, so it's like, it's just being excited about seeing something new. So I'm not necessarily like, oh, this is super my favorite thing, but I look at it, I'm like, this came out really good. I like seeing the process of it completed, even if I don't know what it is.
What I'm going to take a guess, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but your favorite property to work on, and I'm going to say it's Pokemon, just because I feel like that's what you have the most of, just based on my time following you. I might be wrong about that, but I think it's Pokemon. So now the big question is, what is your favorite property to work on and why in particular?
My favorite property is probably Marvel. Marvel, like Spider-Man stuff. Like I like doing, my favorite pieces are when I do like a comic book cover. Like I did, like I've done Amazing Fantasy 15. I've done Secret Wars number 8. I did the first appearance of Silver Surfer. And those are my favorite just because they take a lot of time and effort, and they're more like wow pieces. I do enjoy doing the Pokemon stuff, but that's more of like they sell.
They sell really well,
and so I like doing them for that reason, and they're pretty cool. Like I just recently did a Pikachu Funko Box mirror.
It's my literal, I told you when you started making it, it's my favorite thing that you've ever made. Like, it is literally my favorite thing that you ever made. And I showed it to so I was telling my fiance that you were coming on, and she's like, oh, what does he do? I said, oh, let me show you. And I showed her that, and she goes, okay, that's one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Like, because we're both Pokemon lovers, and we both love Funkos. So it was very funny to see you doing that. And when you started making it, I remember saying, like, oh, I see where this is going, and I like it. And then when you finish, I'm like, oh my God, it's even better than it looked like in the original. It was such a great idea. I have a feeling a lot of people are going to start asking you for those.
Yeah, it's like, it was like kind of a balance of trying to find because when I do a piece like that, it's almost a risk. I'm like, I have no idea if anybody's going to want to buy this. It's going to take time, money, especially putting a mirror in it. It's a little more expensive than some of the other pieces that I make that don't have a mirror. And so I'm like, I have to balance of what I think I could sell this piece for and how much work it's going to be. And so I had to try to find the right Funko Pop because there's thousands and thousands of Funkos. So,
and when you need it, as people have found out, guaranteed, if you want a guaranteed sale, put Pikachu on it.
That's why I'm like, okay, this box isn't too difficult to do. It's something that has wide appeal. And so I think it was the right one to do.
Do you still have it, or have you sold it?
I made two of those.
Okay.
One of them I'm saving for the con I have coming up next month, and then one of them I did sell.
That was fast.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because the amount of... It's funny, knowing this whole thing is done by hand now has changed my whole approach to how I wanted to ask you questions, but how do you price this stuff? Because, I mean, it's easy to just say, well, just look at the number of hours and look at the amount of materials and put them together and come with a formula. And I swear the people that say that have never actually sold a thing in their life, because they don't understand that that's all well and good, but you're also dealing with a market. And the market will bear what the market will bear. So, yes, you may have $7,000 into it to make your favorite Warcraft figurine, but that doesn't mean somebody's going to pay you for it. So how do you price the stuff that you make? Because I'm sure you're constantly having to kind of find that balance between, this took me a lot of hours, and, yeah, I might have to take a loss just on time because the market value of this isn't what I can get back for my time and materials. So how do you price your stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I wish I had an algorithm or a mathematical equation that I do that would make it be like, okay, this is going to be the price. But it literally, I just look at the image and I think, how much work is this going to be? Is this something I'm going to enjoy doing? Is it like something that I think I can actually do? And if it's a custom order, it's a little bit, you know, it's easier. It's more of like, is this something that I'm going to enjoy doing? Is it like, how many layers is it going to be? How many different colors is it? And it's based on what I've sold in the past that might have that level of detail, and what I think I can get for it. What do I think that this piece, you know, is worth? And it's almost like a guessing game, really. I don't like, I don't plug in numbers into something of like, oh, this is going to take me this many hours and this many cans of paint and this many like blades and sheets of sandpaper. I don't think about that. I think of just like how much detail is in it. Like, a lot of people, they'll ask me, how much would you charge for a two foot piece? That's 2 feet by 2 feet. And I don't price it that way. It has like, size of a piece is a very distant second when it comes to pricing a piece. It's more about detail and how much work it's going to be, how many layers it's going to be. If somebody orders a piece and it's 1 foot by 1 foot, there's really not going to be much of a difference in price if they bump it to 2 foot by 2 foot. It'll be different price, but it's not going to be much different. It's still it's almost the same amount of work. It's a little bit more cutting, but not much. If it's actually bigger, is almost easier for me to cut.
Easier. Sure.
Yeah. Because if it starts to get super detailed and small, like, I'll tell people, I won't do this piece smaller than this many inches, because it's too small. That's the downside of doing it by jigsaw, is I can only go so small with certain things. Right. And then if it's a piece that I'm making for a con that is not a custom order, it's the same thing. I think about the pieces I've done in the past and what I think I could sell it for. It's just a guessing game. I'm sure there are pieces that I could get a lot more for, and I list it for too little. And I'm sure there's pieces that I've listed for too much, but there's also been pieces that I've priced it at one thing where I think I'll sell it at, and I've had it for a year, and then I'm just like, I just want to get rid of it, and I'll sell it.
And that's, I can imagine that in your situation, because you produce a lot of inventory in general. So having stuff sitting around is not ideal first of all, you have to like kind of take care of it, so to speak, because you don't want it to get beaten up while it's sitting around, but also just the amount of space that the volume of work that you produce would take up. I can imagine you just don't want that just sitting around all the time.
Yeah. The lucky thing is, like, I'll never lose money on a piece. Right. The MDF is cheap. Spray paint, it's a few cans of spray paint per piece, and primer and stuff. But as long as I am selling a piece for more, like if it's a large piece, if I sell it for more than $50, I'm not losing anything. if it's a small piece, if I sell it for more than 15, 20 bucks, I'm not losing anything. It's just, it's more of like a hit to my ego or a hit to my like, oh, I guess that's not a piece I'll make again. And there are some pieces that just surprise me that they don't sell. And it's, you never know why. Like there's been pieces where everybody's like, whoa, that's so awesome. And, but they don't buy it. And
then I know that,
okay, I priced that piece too much. And then especially when I'm doing conventions and like a lot of anime cons or comic cons, it's hard to sell like the top end pieces, like sell a piece that's $1,000 or so like when I first started and first one or two cons I did, I was trying to make every piece I made like a showstopper piece where it's like, this is going to be $1,000 piece or even an $800 piece or $500. And now I'm like, okay, that's not really the market in cons. A lot of times it's like people are trying to buy lots of things from different vendors. They're not, they don't want to spend all their money in one booth and then be done for the day. Like, that's why I started making smaller pieces and making pieces that are like, okay, like this, these pieces I can make quickly and they're less, they're more broad audience of like more people can afford this. Like that was a thing. I was making these super expensive pieces and it's like, why is no one buying these? And it's hard when they're not a custom order. And I'm just hoping that somebody buys it.
You, it's funny because you have people would automatically assume that you, like you go to like RetroCon or some of the big like Comic-Con, any of these big shows, and you know you have a hot audience that wants everything that has their favorite property all over it. But the reality is that they're at a con, and there's a lot of people that have their favorite property all over it.
Exactly, and a lot of them are they're teens or they're in their 20s. Mm-hmm. They're not these like Mr. Moneybags walking around at a con. They're just trying to have fun. And like, I take it as a huge compliment if they're willing to spend any money in my booth, because they there's hundreds of other vendors there to buy stuff from and that they want to spend their money in my booth. So I'm not like, I, why aren't these people spending hundreds or thousands of dollars in my booth? So that's why I'm trying. I try to make it that I have price range for everybody. And like, I've started even making like pieces that are like the size of the palm of my hand for like $20-$25. And then I have pieces that are like,
oh wow,
the size of like a foot, like a 12 by 12 for like $50-$75. And then my And then my larger pieces that are 18 inches and up, I try to, when I do a con, I try to keep most of them around $150 to $350. And then every once in a while I'll have like a large, like show-stopping piece that's like $800 or $900, you know. But I don't make everything that price,
right? Now, can you? You couldn't, right? I mean, I think there's, I think that's a sign of experience where you've done this before, so now you know that you have a sweet spot. Where is the sweet spot for people buying stuff? Is it that $50 to $100? Those slightly larger, but not like gigantic pieces, and slightly smaller.
The majority of what I sell are the pieces that are like 1 foot by 1 foot, roughly around that size, that range between $50 to $100.
Right.
Because then that's people like, you know, one of the complaints I also got was, I love your work, but I have no wall space.
I have no wall space for it.
It's surprising how many people have no wall space. So it's like, okay, I'll make some smaller stuff. Get rid of that excuse people have. You have space for this. You have space. So those are like, if I do a con, I'll bring hundreds of pieces and I'll probably sell maybe like 100 to 120 pieces that are in the $50 to $100 range. Okay. And then maybe 20 pieces that are in the $200 to $300 range. So it's like, it's definitely the majority of what I sell is the cheaper pieces. And when I first started, other artists told me that they're like, you got to have smaller, cheaper pieces. And I was like, I've never done a smaller, cheaper piece. I think I'll be okay. And then after a couple cons, it's like, yeah, I got to have a lot of smaller.
All the friends I have that do different shows and stuff, they all say the same thing. Those are what you call the pay for the booth pieces. Like, yeah. The pieces that make you break even. And then your bigger pieces are your profit pieces. The ones, but you need to pay the bills too. Like otherwise, because if the table costs you, you know, $600 for the weekend, and you sell four $20 pieces, well, that's, you're screwed. You know,
yeah, exactly.
But if you sell a whole bunch of those cheaper pieces, you can easily make the price of the booth. Then everything you sell above that is profit.
Yeah.
How do you decide? I'm assuming you have kind of a good ear for what conferences are good to sell stuff at. Like, where are you located, by the way? You're in California?
I'm in Northern California. I'm just outside of Sacramento.
Okay. How do you decide which shows you're going to go to? How far do you travel for shows? Like, do you go? Because I imagine lugging that much inventory is kind of tricky. Like, you're not necessarily going to be doing Connecticut Horror Fest with it.
No.
Even though it's a great show, by the way, if you ever wanted to come, I'd be happy to to work the booth with you on anytime you want to come. But, you know, how far do you travel? Like, what kind of cons do you seek out?
At this point, I probably do like maybe 6 cons a year, and I try to stick within a couple hours or 2 or 3 hours of my area.
That's a pretty big circle.
Yeah, I mean, I would maybe not even that far. I think the farthest one I did was maybe an hour and a half away. Yeah, okay. That's probably, yeah, like, because then after that, I have to get a hotel, have to get food.
And everything you do starts eating into your profits.
Yeah, eating my profits. Like, Sacramento area has enough cons for me to do to where I don't have to, I can keep my costs low. I just have to pay for the booth spot, and that's it. Like, I did one in San Francisco last year, and it was a great con. I wish I would have loved to do it again this year, but I transport all my stuff in a trailer. And trying to drive in downtown San Francisco with a trailer is nearly impossible. So I was like, okay, I have to rent a U-Haul. And then so I rented a U-Haul van. And even the van was too big for all the parking garages down there. So then it's like, so I had to pay for the U-Haul van. I had to pay for a hotel room. I had to pay for food. Have to find street parking. It just became such a big thing to do. And the cost was way more. So I just like sticking locally. I would like to do some like cons in LA, or there's a big one in San Jose called Fanime that's really popular, but there's a huge wait list, but it's just a lot to leave family. And then I have my wife and son. It's like, do they come with me? I don't really expect them to work my booth with me. And then it's like, so if they come with me, then they're just on a trip by themselves while I work. And then if they're home, then it's like, I'm not home for like 3 or 4 days. It's just like, I'm kind of a homebody. I like to be home. So
don't we all?
Like, my local area has enough cons to where I'm happy and I make enough to do them. And then I'm in 4 stores locally, and just keeping those stocked with stuff and then doing the cons and custom orders. I don't even know what I would do if I was doing more cons.
I kind of like when I, you know, when I see your pictures, like when you take a picture from inside one of the stores and I see your display in the store, it's like, oh wow, like that's really cool. Like, it's not just cons or him selling, like there's stores showing your stuff too. I don't know. I just like really want you to win, because it's like, I like your stuff so much, and it's just so much, it feels like it's just so much better than I went to RetroCon in Philly in September, and I loved it. I thought it was great. And there were a couple of people selling this kind of the stuff that you make, but it was, you know, it was like, it was okay. You know, it didn't pop the way your stuff does. And there was something, and this is why I started following you a million years ago, it feels like. There was something poppy about the way you design it. Like, you managed to capture the right essence of stuff. It's not just the design, because design is the easy part. The design, especially when you're doing pop culture, the design kind of figured out for you.
Yeah.
But it's interpreting that design into something that makes a good piece of art. That's where you have a knack for. Like, I love watching when you post a finished product and it's like, oh wow, he caught all little nuances, all little shapes. And again, that's why the jigsaw thing is so impressive. But your stuff just looks so good, especially when you have the wide array of stuff all up on the walls like that. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It's like a balancing act. I mean, as an artist, I still struggle with like self-doubt, you know, of like, am I really good? And then so when I hear people say that, like, it's really cool. Like, that's one thing I love about working the cons, like, is just having people come up and say how awesome the stuff is. And it's like more face-to-face and get to see people's reaction versus just seeing like a heart or a like on a post. So it's really cool. Right. But I mean, yeah, it's like, there are people who try to like do what I do and copycat. And I get a lot of people to say like, you know, that my stuff is better. So it's like, it's cool to see that. And it sucks when there are copycats, but it's also like, you can't do it as good as me. Like,
no,
it's one of those things where it's like, I have that self-doubt sometimes. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm doing very good. And then sometimes I'm like, no, I am good. It's weird.
I'm good at this.
It's one of those things where
isn't it crazy that your mind can simultaneously have a ton of self-doubt and then swagger all at the same time?
Yeah, it's really weird. Like it's like, yeah, I'm like, this piece was really good. Like, oh, this is awesome. And then I see someone like, oh, they're trying to do like me. Does that mean they're better than me? Are they going to do it as good as me? And so, yeah, it's,
there's a good chance they probably respect your work. That's why they're imitating it. I mean, I know that's not the greatest thing in the world to hear. Like, oh, great. So he's going to knock off my stuff because he likes me. And yeah, that sucks. But in a way, it's kind of like, look, I'm good enough that people are imitating what I do.
Yeah. Well, there was one store that I was in last year and it was selling really well. And then they kind of got like, they thought that they could just do it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they started knocking it off and like it didn't really end very well. Cause they sure. like, you know, so there's that where it's like, you kind of get butthurt when things like that happen and you're like, okay, well, but then that store is now out of business. Like after they did that, like 5 months later, they were closed. So it's like, well, but I try to take it upon myself. Like, even though there are a lot of people who do what I do, they may not do it the same way. Like I'm totally open to answering people's questions. I get a lot of other artists, which is like the biggest compliment I can get from somebody is they're they ask me for advice. They'll message me and, how do you do this? How do you do this? And, you know, what's your process and stuff? And I'm maybe a little too open with how I do things and giving people advice, but I have no problem helping people. So if like anybody ever wants to message me and ask me questions, I'm pretty much an open book. I don't really like, I'm never like, that's my secret. And I'm like, if you want to try to do it and you think you could do it, do it. I know that I can. So go ahead and try, you know, it's like, so if you want to know how I do it, I'm cool with that, with helping people.
I've been having this conversation a lot with particularly artists and other makers and other creative people where I am really starting to take notice of people who have an abundance mindset versus people that have a scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tend to gravitate toward the people that have an abundance mindset like that. People that can have the confidence that inspiring someone and even teaching someone how to do even the things that they do is not going to hurt them. It's only going to make everything better for everybody. And people with abundance mindsets truly do believe that me helping you only makes both of us better. It doesn't make you take away from me. You're not taking away from me. If I'm successful, I'm not taking away from you. I mean, granted, if I'm in your same neighborhood and I'm copying your work,
then,
all right, maybe that's a different story, right? But the reality is that in most situations, there's enough pie for everybody. Everybody gets a decent sized slice. Yeah. And I love the mindset of helping people to learn the thing that you're very good at. Because if people are asking you, first of all, I don't think people realize this, but I mean, you've probably been through it. I know I've been through it. It's hard to even ask somebody who's very good at something, how do you do that? Because it's kind of like uncomfortable. It's like, I don't want them to think I'm stealing their idea, but I really genuinely would like to know how they do this. It's why most of us that make stuff follow so much of it on YouTube, because we want to learn. We want to learn how these people do this stuff. So it really is impressive that you have that mindset, because you are, this is your business. You're not just doing this for content creation, for, you know, glory. You're doing it as a business. And yet you still have the mindset of, I still kind of owe it to the people that ask me to help them out if they have a question, because I'm the expert and I need to be able to help people.
Well, I mean, it's amazing that people, I mean, like I said, I've really only been doing this for like a little over 3 years.
Which is wild.
It blows my mind that people ask me how to do it. Like when I first started, I hadn't I wasn't even on Instagram. I wasn't following any other artists. I just kind of did it on my own. And so it's like, if I got to the point, if like, if I got to the point where people are asking me how I did it, then I must be doing something right. And mm-hmm. that just, it's a huge compliment to me. So I'm willing to pay back their compliment with actual advice.
Have you ever worked on a piece where you weren't particularly happy with it, but it was, I don't want to say good enough, cause that sounds terrible, but it was good, but you weren't like over the moon about it. And then you post it and somebody goes, oh my God, that's amazing. And it kind of changed your opinion about it. Cause I imagine with the amount of pieces you've made, that has to have happened at least once or twice.
It probably has, but honestly, I'm trying to think, like, I might not post a piece if I wasn't happy with it. Like, you know, it's like, I might just be like, I'll sell it, but I don't know if I'll post it. There's been a few times, I mean, I'm obviously not going to say what it is, but there's been a couple times where people will do a custom order and I'm just like not into it. And I don't think it's something worth posting. I'm like, this doesn't really fit my style. This isn't really like a piece that's like that my audience is going to appreciate or be, you know, I've done some different logos or different things for clients and stuff. And it's just like, I'm just not going to post this one. But
have you ever pulled the plug on something midway? Cause it just wasn't turning out the way you wanted to. Like, have you ever just said, this is not going to work. Like I can't do this.
Yeah.
Or have you have?
Yeah. It's like, you know, where this piece is just, it's going to be too daunting, too much. And I don't think I'll get the return on it that it's going to, that the time will take. I usually figure that out very quickly though. Like it's a very quick process where it's like, no, this is not going to work for me. Like it's, it rarely gets to the cutting point where I've done that. Once I start cutting, I know that I'm in it. Like it's usually like, okay, there's been times where I've made a template and it's like, and which has taken, sometimes will take like a long, like over an hour to make a template and like get it to that point. And I'm just like, this is too big. This is too much detail for just a piece that I hope somebody buys. So yeah, it's happened.
Have you considered, now this is going to be a big question, I'm curious about it now. Have you considered changing your production methods and doing like lasers, for example? Like, have you considered any of that kind of stuff? Or is it because the reason I ask is when somebody's working with hand tools the way you are, a lot of those people who do stuff the way you do it get very dogmatic about never touching a laser, and I will never use a CNC, and I will never do this. And I'm totally okay with that. I don't have a problem with that. It's your artistic vision done the way you want it to do. But I'm just curious, is that you, or are you more of the, you never know, one day down the line, I may need to produce on a, you know, kind of mass produce a little more, and that might be an option.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about it. Like, so I have a friend who has a CNC, and I made one piece on the CNC. He kind of showed me how like it was done, and you know, like the cutting process, and it was cool. Like, but then it just leaves the cutting is my favorite part, and so it just leaves me with the sanding, which is one of my least favorite parts.
Nobody likes sanding except me.
And then the painting, which can be the most frustrating part because you have the least amount of control. And then it's like, then what am I doing? You know, it's like, I might get to the point where it's like, I have to start just doing it to like get mass produce things. Mm-hmm. But I think it would change what I'm doing at this point. Right now, I still enjoy the cutting and, you know, it makes up for the other things I don't like. Mm-hmm. So if I were to do it, it would just be different. I would probably still do some custom pieces by hand and then CNC or something like that for the smaller mass produced pieces and stuff like that. But I'm not there yet, but I probably will eventually. I think you kind of have to. You can only, if you're a one man show, you can only do so much without. I mean,
hire people.
I'm in my 40s. I can only do this for so long by hand. You know, I'm not like getting lower back problems and things like that. I can, you know.
One of my friends said years ago, he said that, you know, he's, because I was looking at a CNC, and then I was looking at the Shaper Origin, which is basically a router, but with a computer built into it. So it kind of works like a CNC, but you still have to move it around.
Oh, yeah.
And I was thinking of getting that because I thought that would be a better fit for me because it fits in a smaller space. And he said, don't do it. And I'm like, why? He said, because when you get a CNC or a laser, it's like hiring your first employee. And I was like, huh. He goes, if you want it to save you time, you can't be standing over it using it.
Yeah.
And it just, you're like, yeah, that's a good point. Like, cause you are kind of hiring your first employee. And you know, you, like you said, when you're a one man show, you have two options to get faster. You can become a two man show, or you can make your one time have things going on concurrently that you aren't necessarily actively involved in. So
yeah.
I was always I've said it a couple of times on this episode, but your output is, you're so prolific that it just blows my mind that you're doing this all by hand, because I don't know how you keep up that pace. It just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, obviously you can do it. I've seen the results.
So, I mean, I'm working, my wife has to like pull me away. I probably do this for like 10 hours a day, five plus days a week. And like with the stacked cutting, like I can cut multiple pieces at the same time. So it allows me almost to, in a way, mass produce pieces while still doing it by hand. Like I can cut like with the stack cutting, and I can cut like four sheets thick. And because the wood's not very thick, like we talked about. So I can cut like four sheets thick at a time, which allows me to cut like basically four pieces at a time. And then, you know, with the sanding all at once, and then the priming and the painting all at once, kind of gives me just a good process of getting it out. But there are limits to how much I can make.
Of course.
And, you know, I'm working all the time, not just when I'm preparing for a con. Like that's one of the reasons why I'm able to keep the stores that I'm in stocked and do cons, because I just always have stuff. I'm never like low on anything. I'm always like making pieces, even if I have nothing going on. I have no custom orders. I have no con in sight, and the sales at the stores are dead because it's not a high traffic time. I'm still making stuff all the time. It's like
always building inventory.
Yeah, always building it, just because, you know, it's always gotta, you know, I just want to be ready, and I can only make so much at a time. So there's only so much hours in the day, so I have to prepare myself so I'm not rushing at the end. Like when I first started, I definitely wasn't this fast.
Mm-hmm. That's probably one of those things that you notice. You don't notice in the moment. You notice it in hindsight, where, you know, you finish a whole bunch of stuff and you go, wow, that didn't take anywhere near as long as it used to take.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm really happy that it's enough for you to have a full time and be your full time passion, because a lot of people do cool stuff and it's like it's their side hustle or it's the thing that they do because they like doing it, but it doesn't really make them a whole lot of money. The fact that you're able to parlay this into full time is phenomenal to me.
I'm definitely lucky. I mean, like, you know, like I hear about that a lot, like people who turned a side hustle into something full time during the pandemic. Like that was almost like one of the very few benefits of being in lockdown and having that whole situation is I just had time. Like before, I didn't really have time for anything and didn't have the boredom to try to find and look for something to fill my day with. And so without that, I would not be doing this. Like making a living by selling art was literally never even a thought to me. Like growing up, I was never like, I'm going to be a professional artist. And like, and then I'm in my late 30s at the time. And I think like, oh, can I do this for a living? Like it's just something that never was on my radar. And even when I first started, my wife, she doubted it, obviously. She was like, well, you got to get a little better. And I'm like, are you sure? Maybe I could sell these. And so it's just, one of those things where, like, it's a surprise to me because it never even occurred that this could be a future for me. Like, I always thought, like, okay, I'd be running the photography and photo booth rental company and try to figure something, you know, but I wasn't really happy doing that. And so the fact that I was able to find this and be happy at it, it just amazes me.
So what was your last question I'm going to ask you before I let you go? What was your aha moment? What was the moment where you said, oh, yeah, this is a thing. Like, this is a big thing. This is the thing I can pretty much shift my focus to and, you know, chew on this permanently. Like, this is my new bone. I'm a happy dog now. What was your moment?
To be honest, it was when my wife told me they were good enough to sell.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know why that's emotional for me. Like, she supports, it's not like she's like, doesn't support me, but like, you know, she's like a realist and is like, she saw the quality. Like, when I look back at the quality of my first few pieces, mm-hmm. I saw them as like, these are good. I'm doing a great job. And then when I look back, I'm like, those were not good. Those were, so it's like, I think, like, I'm surprised. I'm like, people bought those and they spent money on them. It's like, grant, like, they weren't as expensive as they are now, but I'm like, I can't believe people paid for these. And so I had blinders on, you know, it's like, where it was something that I made, so I was proud of it and I couldn't see the flaws in it. And so when somebody else that loves me is honest with me, she was like, these are okay, you know, they're not the greatest. And so when she got to the point and my son got to the point of like, these are really good, you can sell these, you should, like, and people were like, do a convention and stuff, and just that validation, that's when I was like, yeah, I could do this. And it's worked out.
That demonstrates, and that made me smile, because, you know, you getting emotional about it tells me how important this is to you. It made me smile because it's so nice when the people you love don't blow sunshine off your ass and are literally just, they'll look, sometimes the truth hurts, but that truth, if she had told you at that point that your stuff was good enough and you just started selling that, and okay, maybe it was lukewarm and some people, you know, hey, let's support Chris, let's buy his stuff. Maybe you wouldn't have taken off the way it did, right? But the fact that she told you the truth and it's like, you need to get better before this can be a thing. And then you went and got better and now it is a thing. I mean, that's a big honking deal. Like, that is, that's awesome. I love that. That makes me super duper happy when I hear that, because people are scared to tell the truth sometimes. They don't want to do that. But
She'll tell me the truth for sure. But I mean, like when I first started, there was one piece, it was the first and only time it ever happened, where somebody custom ordered a piece and they arrived to pick it up and they were like, I don't think I'm going to take, they ordered two pieces and they were like, we'll take this one, but we don't want to take that one. And so that was kind of like a big blow, you know, like, where it was the only time it's ever happened. And it was, I had only been doing it a few months. So it's like, now it doesn't really affect me. But at the time I was like, they didn't want this piece. This piece is great. What are they talking about? And so it's like, definitely have grown alive. Never, nothing like that has ever happened since. So
I'm going to take a minute because it seems like our internet connection is having an issue, because you've actually dropped out a little bit on me, but that's okay. We're good. We're still good. We're still good. We still have good audio. I'm going to read off the names of the people that make this show possible, and hopefully things recover enough so we can do a proper outro with you, because I have really, really enjoyed chatting with you today. This has been a lot of fun. The people that make this show and all this revelry possible include Best Man Al Schultz from New York Woodworks, Scott Oram from Dad It Yourself DIY, Ed Swanson from Ed's Clocks and More, Nick Birchtold of Birchtold Design Build, Ross Cave, Tori Decker of Tori Did It, Jake Drews of Make With Jake, Megan Chris from Onyx Designs Woodwork, Christian Neary of Warren Works, Ken Madden of Mad K Studios, David Wood of DW Wood Builds, Dean Duplantis, Jeff Stein, a.k.a. A Weird Guy, Kim and Garrett from Kim and Garrett Make It, Rory Langefeld of RLL Woodworks and DIY, Robert J. Keller, Brian Arsenault, the Seven Hills Maker, Dave Bauer of Dave Bauer Art, Donald LeBlanc of Fun with Woodworking, Miguel Angel Vilela, Darkest Web Designs, Jeremy Spies, Grant Alexander from the Clamp Podcast, Brad Harrison of Brad's Customs, Billy Poulton of Poulton Projects, Eric Peterson of Overall Makerworks, and Earl Van Alstein. I am so grateful to all of you for supporting the show. Most of you have been supporters since the beginning, and even the ones that haven't, I appreciate you all, because I couldn't do this show without you. And if I didn't have a bunch of supporters, I would have no legitimacy, and then I couldn't get guests like Chris to come on this show, even though I've known him a while. But I can say, hey, you know the show, right? Yeah, I know the show. All right, cool. But Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you, man. Like I said, I feel like I've been following you forever, and the nugget that you did this all by hand, man, I wish I knew that earlier, because I would have been even more impressed by the stuff you did.
Well, thank you. But, pleasure's all mine.
Where can people find your stuff? I mean, I know you sell at cons, you have your stuff in stores and stuff, but where can people find you, get in touch with you, maybe order something from you, or where can they find your stuff? Like, help people help you, Chris.
So the main thing I use is Instagram. Like, that's the best place to find me. It's going to be Hang It Up Art with underscores in between each word. That's probably the best place. I'm very quick and about getting back to messages, even the ones that come in my hidden folders. I try to make sure that nothing goes unread and unresponded to. So there, I believe I have my phone number on my account.
You can
text me, you can call me. And if you have questions, if you don't want to message me there, I'll answer my texts and calls too. So that's the best place to get a hold of me.
I can attest to the fact that he is very quick at responding to messages on Instagram. It's kind of freakish how fast he responds. He's way faster than I am. I will say that much. Anything coming down the road, any cons coming up or any shows? I mean, I know it's kind of the end of the year and this is not exactly con season, but I know you said you had one in January coming.
Yeah. It's January 5th, 6th, and 7th in Sacramento. Okay. It's called Sac Anime. It's one of the biggest ones I do. They do it twice a year. They do it in September, and then they do it in January. And so that's the one I'm preparing for now. And I love this con. It's one of my favorite ones to do. It's got such a long wait list for vendors that the only reason I'm probably in it right to this day is because the first con I did was this con right after the pandemic started opening up. And I was able to swoop in there and get a spot before, you know, everybody, all the other vendors were traveling. So I'm holding on to the spot as long as I can, because I like this con. And then after that, in February, I have one in Stockton, California, called Stockton Con, and I'll do one in March. And I have like five or six throughout the year. But the next one, yeah, Sac Anime in January in Sacramento.
That's excellent. So everybody, keep your eyes on his Instagram account, because I'm pretty sure you announced, I'm assuming you announced where you're going to be on there also.
Yeah.
You tell people. Okay.
Yeah, great. I tell people. Yeah.
Keep an eye on his Instagram account. This way you can hit up the cons that he's displaying at, or just hit him up either way, and maybe you can figure out something that he can make for you that you can order. Because I'm telling you, as you've seen throughout this episode, if you've seen in the B-roll as we're chatting, the stuff is pretty incredible. And Chris, I'm just, as someone who's an admirer of your work, you are an incredibly talented artist, and it has been a huge honor for me to get to chat with you today, and I appreciate you giving me so much of your time this afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate your time as well.
And that's going to do it for this week. I will be back, of course, again next week, I think the week after, and then it's time for Christmas break, because we're getting close and close. Look, guys, hold on. Look. I have a Christmas tree. Thank God Kathy's here, because otherwise that would just be the corner that you've been seeing for the entire year that this show's been around. But that's going to do it for this week. I will be back again next week. I may be back again the week after. Who knows? Who knows? But stick around. You never know what you might find on this show. You might find some talented artists, some new friends, or some people you might want to follow, like Chris. And I hope you enjoyed it. See you then.